Hi again. They're going to be setting up for the panel behind me, but I'd like to remind you guys that there are t-shirts available. CodeCon t-shirts for sale, limited number. Coming up next is the last presentation of the day. Panel we've called Money, Do We Need It? A lot of the projects you've seen displayed here are open source projects. Other ones have interesting revenue models. We're going to have a couple of people that have been through this discuss how to survive when you have to work pretty hard or take an interesting slant to raise money, and how to get by without it, or what exactly is reasonable to expect you need. Our moderator here, we don't need tables. Our moderator is going to be Paul Holman of the Shmoo Group, and he is somewhere around. Paul. And anyway, here's Paul.
I guess we just need a minute to set up.
Am I going to have two mics? I can keep this mic.
There's some other folks on this panel who are going to join me up here. You guys are going to have to share. Yeah, we are, if that's okay. Oh, do you need your laptop for something? Oh, some notes, I see. Okay. Well, we'll leave that there, and why don't we pull these other tools back. Actually, Michael, pull this table up over here so you can bring your laptop on. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to try and get going here. You guys may have noticed, but we're on a bit of a tight schedule. People will come and start dancing any moment, so we have to get out of here.
I feel like dancing now.
We have two microphones, so I'm going to hang on to mine, and they're going to share that one. And hopefully this will be worthwhile for you guys. There's it's a tough market, I think, that we're in, which puts pressure on people trying to raise money for projects. But even aside from that, it's a lot of work to start a business and raise money, especially for a new project that hasn't been done before. And I know some of you guys are familiar with sort of the venture capital scene and how that works, but these are some guys who have some experience with raising money to fund open source projects and some fringe wacko projects. So hopefully you guys can learn a lot from them. I'm going to be here trying to extract interesting answers from them. But I'm going to ask each guy to introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about what they've done in the past and where they're coming from as far as what it takes to raise money to fund some of the cooler coder-oriented projects. Starting with Brian Behlendorf, who probably all of you have heard of.
Okay, how much time? Like 5 minutes?
Take about 5 minutes.
Okay. So I worked at a company called Organic Online like a while ago, left that in 1998 after having started it. It would build websites for big companies and stuff. And it started out as just like four guys with a bunch of computers creating some of the first HTML and stuff like that. And the only reason I mention that is because, you know, that was like kind of where I got my first taste of what it's like to try to like run a business while trying to do interesting and fun and cool things at the same time. And it was hard. I mean, most of the time you don't end up doing the creative stuff. Most of the time you're sitting in front of a customer, you know, dealing with like really silly bullshit they throw you. But one of the things that was significant about that to open source was that we weren't in the business of building, you know, commercial web servers. We were building websites, but we needed a better web server. And so in that kind of context, it made sense for us to have, you know, me spending half my time or a third or whatever it was, and maybe a few other people in the company, on improving Apache, right? And that was the same justification that everyone else could make, and you get this enough of a critical mass around it, and pretty soon you have an open source project. But the important thing is it wasn't like a software company that had a commercial web server that was funding the development of something that was, you know, a competitor to it, basically. It was end users who had a need to go out and do that, or companies that had a need for that kind of software, taking kind of a long-range view of things. And, you know, was this like a rigorously tested business principle or anything? No. It was like, you know, me doing it because it was fun and I could come up with a good excuse for it. So 1998, I left Organic, and that was when, you know, Mozilla came out, you know, hi, Jamie, and a lot of other open source things were starting to happen. And I said to myself, you know, writing this kind of software is really fun. I'd love to do it full time, and I think it'd be kind of good if a lot of other people could do it full time. And that, to me, meant, well, we could all go form a commune up and land in Northern California or something like that, or we could figure out how to, like, draw a salary for it, right? How to, you know, do more than just kind of justify it on this kind of incidental, because it's fun basis and make up excuses for it, but actually try to turn it into something real. So I wrote a chapter for the book Open Sources on, the chapter was how to try to turn it into a business, how to build a business. And I just kind of recited all the common things that everyone points to, Red Hat and to Cygnus and things like that. And also kind of the things that were kind of big at the time in terms of .com ideas, which were like, give something away for free so that you can cause your competitors to all fall over themselves and you can make money somewhere else, right? Of course, the problem was in the .com world when everybody was doing that, you know, basically commoditizing everybody else's business, right? Everyone went out of business because no one could form like a profitable company around anything. So after writing that chapter, I started getting a lot of people saying, hey, we're going to be the Red Hat of databases or the Red Hat of geographic mapping software. Or, you know, they wanted to be like the open source blah of some category of software. Will you be on our advisory board or whatever? So I joined a few of these. And oftentimes, you know, it was just a matter of putting together some kind of, in many cases, some substandard software and a small little thin layer on top of it and pretending that that could make a business. And it almost became like a form of fetishism where people people were like, you know, oh yes, this will automatically work because, you know, we're giving it away for free, thus it instantly translating into massive adoption. And if we can make money from a tenth of a percent of those people, we'll, you know, be profitable in month five. No, it didn't work like that. So I decided to give it a try. I decided to see, well, if all these other, you know, people are succeeding or not, what could we do? And so I came up with this like grandmaster vision for how open source developers could get paid for their work. And it was kind of like a combination of eBay and Elance, there's some all these other sites. So the idea was let open source developers bid to develop stuff that companies needed done. And I won't do a full kind of postmortem on it, but basically we gave it a good year and a half where I went out, we built a prototype, we built an actual site, raised funding for it, came up with all these wild visions about how, you know, it'd be how most software development was about to be done, had everyone say, oh, this is a great idea. But there were just these problems that were inherent to the way that it was designed, that when you go out and you try to sell it to somebody, they didn't like it, right? So this is 1999 is when we started CollabNet, and Source Exchange was the name of this site. CollabNet was always going to be about more than just one idea, because if you're thinking about like starting a business or whatever, you never want to be pigeonholed into just one kind of thing, because you might find out that that doesn't work. And almost any company you could probably cite to you, you know, it was doing something by its first or second year that was radically different than what its business plan said it would be doing. And so there was another idea, which was about the tools that developers use in the open source community to more effectively cooperate and share code. I mean, even it's the basic stuff. It's CVS, it's IssueZilla, it's mailing lists. And so right now, CollabNet as a company is about providing that kind of software. I don't want to turn this into an infomercial, so I'll just put this out there. It's about doing that for companies. And in most cases, it's not about writing open source software. In most cases, it's about helping some big IT company get its 1,000 internal engineers spread out around the world to be sharing code with each other, right? So again, this is intended to be 5 minutes. Business is about compromise. Business is not about taking a brilliant idea and then figuring out later how to make money from it. Business is about finding a group of people with a set of problems that no one else is solving and coming up with a really good idea for solving it that no one else has yet, right? And then all of the nuts and bolts of actually turning it into a business. There's one last thing I wanted to end on, which is when Google put up the archives of Usenet, you know, going back to the 80s, a friend of mine who used to work at Sun, is James Davidson here, Duncan? Anyways, he went back and he found a post from 83 or 82 from Bill Joy, who said, good news, I'm going to be joining a company called Sun Microsystems. It was good news for Bill. It was good news for lots of people at the time. Good news, I'm joining Sun Microsystems, and we're going to be, you know, building a commercialized version of this Berkeley standard distribution software of Unix, basically. And the people who are hiring me have said that, you know, basically all my modifications to the core Unix kernel, I can contribute back to Berkeley and give away for free. Isn't that great? Well, we all know what happened, right? You know, SunOS was never like nothing was contributed back. They went off on Solaris and whatever. And now, last week, that you know, finally Sun says, well, maybe we might do something with Linux. You know, point I'm trying to make is that it's really hard to do out there. And there's some lessons, and maybe some of them will come out during the panel discussion. But it's a lot harder than anyone makes it look.
Brad Templeton. My name is Brad Templeton. I'm a coder and have done a lot of software coding and trying to sell it in the 80s. More people know me both from things I did in the 90s, founding what turned out to be the first of the dot-coms called Clarinet, an electronic newspaper company. And now I'm chairman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which I hope I don't have to introduce to any of you. I've been involved in both trying to build businesses online and software businesses, and actually only recently in the money-raising end of it, because I was able to build that business by its bootstraps, and that tends to be what has to be done, except in the really crazy, wild era that we saw recently, when you have something that's actually revolutionary, because if everyone understood it, it wouldn't be revolutionary. The venture capitalists are not stupid people, but nor are they the people with a revolutionary thought. And unfortunately, right now, you're in about the worst time if you wanted to do something like people were doing 3 or 4 years ago. And the fact that buildings have been falling down hasn't assisted that problem at all. In fact, by and large, it's caused many investors to say, don't even show me business plans right now because I'm uncertain about the state of the world. I've never tried to raise money for an open source project directly, so I can't actually speak on that. I can speak about raising money for things like the EFF, which I try and do all the time, because it's been a very difficult year for all charities, and it's going to be a very difficult year for civil rights as things come on. And right now I'm trying to raise some programming effort and some money for a project to bring encryption into email on an opportunistic basis that would have zero user interface. And so if people are interested in that, I'd be happy to talk to them about it later. I guess the sad thing I have to say is that in the last few years, maybe you in the audience can help us a bit. Who are the open source millionaires of the last couple of years? I mean, after the bubble burst. And I'm not sure there are that many. I mean, I know a few from who made some decent money and who sold correctly during the late 90s. But I think I have to agree with Brian that there was a bit of dream there. And I'm not going to preach happy things to you, but we'll see what we get in the panel.
Mike Roberts, and I arrived in California from England about 10 years ago. I've been doing research in England on parallel programming, and I married an American, and moved over here. And I dropped into what was then the sort of nascent Southern Californian new media industry. I didn't even really know what the word was, but I ended up working for a couple of years at a company called MediaShare. I implemented the basis of what became Kinetics Hyperwire. I think that maybe I'm actually here as the sort of token representative of large numbers of projects that were very cool but never really made it anywhere. But that received quite large amounts of funding. So maybe there's kind of a lesson in there that I can help people with. So after that, I went to work for a large East Coast database company and extracted quite a large amount of money out of them for doing incredibly boring things for several years. And then I left and went off and spent 2 years sitting on the top of a small hill coding. And I wrote in Java what was the basis for the open source project GEL. I then spent another year and a half recoding that with a bunch of guys. We were quite well funded. And the project then fell apart due to not having carefully agreed to start with exactly what it was that we were doing and exactly what license we would be putting it out under and a number of other things. You could sort of line them out into a list of 10,000 things. What that fundamentally comes down to in my mind is a sort of money versus control issue. When you accept money from someone for something, you are giving up in some way your control over that project. There are a lot of people that teach you to release on your creation. So if you talk to the Buddhists or the Hindus, they say, oh, you have to take your act in the world and you have to sort of release on them. But there's a point at which you're actually doing the act, which you don't really want to release on it. And that for me is a very key concept. I want to be able to take my vision and move it through to a point where I feel like it's pretty much intact, and then I want to let it go out in the world on its own legs, and I'm prepared to then sort of release on it and let it do its own thing and be pleasantly surprised or horrified upon what it does. But what I've not found myself able to do, and this may be a psychological flaw on my part, is to release halfway through the creation process. And I think that's something that a lot of us have an issue with.
Well, Microsoft has no problem with it.
I like to maintain my involvement with my children on an ongoing basis. I've actually found, having gone through basically all of the permutations involving money that are possible, I really haven't found a permutation that I like. So I'm forced to conclude that either there's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with money in some fundamental way. So what I actually concluded was that there was something wrong with money. So I started looking at sort of the history of money. And people have been hacking on money since the days of the Crusades. I mean, a lot of very, very smart, very intelligent people have developed systems for moving money around, for completely fleecing people, for using money to control the development of society and technology, particularly for moving hierarchical command and control structures from one domain of technology to another domain of technology. Now what I mean by that is I mean that things change, they evolve. We produce different structures with our technology today than the structures that we had 200-300 years ago, but a lot of the principles are the same. A lot of the hype is the same. If you look at the things that they said about telegraphs, you know, it's eerily similar to what was said about the web. I didn't come up with that, someone else did. If you accept the fact that sort of rolling process occurs, that people wish to take what you produce and your labors and then use them as a mechanism for either reinvesting and preserving their wealth or for generating new wealth, and I'm not necessarily saying that that is a bad thing, but if you accept the fact that that occurs, then the whole thing sort of starts to drop out and seem a little bit clearer, maybe. What we have going on here is we have an ability here to put the kind of control systems in place that we've never had the ability to put in place before. So we can create systems which use small, localized communications mechanisms. You've seen some of them today that exhibit the kind of emergent behaviors that actually do good things. And we can use those to replace the complex, hierarchical, top-down control systems that no one really likes. If you talk to the average Joe in the street, they're not keen on a lot of the things that happen, but they don't seem to relate those things. And that's all an issue about money, and it's about the funding of projects and about other things, but I think I've probably said enough at this point and I'm beginning to veer off topic. So I'm going to hand you back to our erstwhile moderator.
Yeah, no problem. I guess for the purposes of our discussion here, one thing that's, you know, I'll speak for the audience and say that, you know, a lot of us are working on the projects that get us excited, things that we dream about. I'm based in Seattle, and I'm actually the first Seattle wireless node. You guys have probably heard of Seattle Wireless, and we've had a year and a half of hype, and it turns out when I got there, there were no nodes, so I fired one up, and I have a Pringles can on my roof. But, you know, we don't have a business plan. Seattle Wireless is just a community network, right? We just think it's cool that we can do this now. And, you know, a lot of people in Seattle Wireless are working on lots of different projects. We have people working on mapping software and people working on loading Linux on access points, and we have people working on all these different pieces of, because we want to have like self-organizing networks that cut the telco out of the loop, right? Well, a lot of people could look at that and say, oh, there must be a business there, and some people are doing that, but by and large, you know, we're working on projects that will be useful for all kinds of really cool stuff. What we want to know is how can it be made reasonable to live off of that work? Because we're all whoring ourselves out doing Oracle DBA shit or some unknown crap. We're, you know, I'm in Seattle, a lot of people working for Microsoft or derivatives, you know, and there's this sort of situation where, you know, we've gotten to the point where every one of us now is a computer scientist. We're all able to code. We're all able to build the stuff we can dream up, but we need the time to do it, and it would be really cool if we could afford to do it. And so I'm going to ask these guys to ignore the possibility of how we become millionaires for a minute, which is what you would get from any other con, and talk about how can we just, like, get a paycheck and make our projects work, because we've all, you know, all the things we saw this morning and we're going to see over this weekend, they're all cool projects. They all probably deserve to get some attention, and money buys that time. So I'll start with that thought, and we'll go through our speakers again and see what you guys have to say about that. Hand that to Brian.
How to get paid. God, that's a hard question. And you know, like when I wrote that chapter for that book, that was more about like people starting companies, because that was like the in thing in 1998, 1999, was just to wake up in the morning and start a couple companies. But and raise a few million dollars, you know, before lunch.
I don't know. I'd say if you want to work on open source software and get paid to do it, and the shortest path to that I could think of is get a tech job that is about something that is not, you know, writing a commercial software product, or might be, but the key thing here is that allows you to be able to write software underneath it to accomplish some other objective, right? Like the example I gave with Organic. We were building websites. We needed a better web server for it. And so it made sense that rather than spend a couple grand per CPU or whatever it was for Netscape's web server, we would, Jamie. We would write a free one, right? I would imagine that in almost any job that you'd be in where you'd go and you'd work on stuff, there'd be places where you can be, you know, writing stuff for free. I would doubt that that path would get you to writing nothing but free software. And so I don't know a strategy like where to go look for like jobs or things like that specifically for that. But and that's not a strategy as well if you don't want to like compromise your principles and write only GPL'd software or something. So that's about the most crystalline kind of example I could give. The other example might be find something that. Okay, so all the P2P stuff and the other mass distribution stuff that have been talked about today, have had difficulty, or at least aren't right on the radars of all these companies, right, deploying it or anything like that. But if you find stuff that's on the borderline, right, like operating systems, or web servers or whatever, if you start working on it in your spare time and start contributing patches, start getting known for it, right, start having people see the quality of your code, you'll develop a rep. And that reputation can help you land certain jobs, right? Like I can talk just real briefly right now about like we have 20 engineers at our company, roughly 20, 25. There's a bit more in a couple of other areas, but of those, we have three people who are writing something called Subversion, which is a next generation CVS thing. It's under the BSD license. We want everyone using it, right? We've got one or two other people working on some proprietary things that'll be on top of that, right? So it's this like balance between hey, we give a lot of stuff away for free to build an interesting thing, but a few others that help make it so that we get an advantage for it. Likewise, we have three people working full-time on something called Scarab, which is a next-generation bug database, right? Again, BSD licensed, it's Java-based, whatever. And then a few other people thinking about things that are kind of on the top end of that. So I don't know how that led into it. But there are some companies out there still that I think can justify doing that kind of balanced kind of development of work. And so go look for them. Is it working?
Yeah.
Well, I have to continually justify to board members and to other people why we're paying people to then give things away for free, especially since we haven't deployed those technologies yet, right? So we're not. It is definitely long-term R&D. And so it's hard. I can't give you a number and say, yeah, that works as a business strategy just yet. The other point I was going to make is we have another four or five people who we build a lot of stuff on top of Turbine, on top of Jakarta projects and things like that, on top of Apache, and anywhere from 20% to 80% of the stuff that they write ends up back into the open as well. So it's this kind of incidental work that is about as close as you could probably get. But if you have some really big, like brand new idea, I think you got to let it gestate, go sit on top of a mountain for a year and a half. And I think, unfortunately, you got to think about, here's the bits I'm going to give away for free, and here's the bits that, maybe it's give away for free and I build some service around it, or maybe it's, this is a proprietary piece of software on top of it. I don't know. I mean, I wish I had a clearer sense of it, but it's very situation specific.
I mean, I have tended not to answer that question you asked, because I do like to think big, and I always think in terms of if I'm going to do a software project, how is this software project going to change the world? And that's usually not talking about just getting a few users so I can get lucrative consulting contracts from people who like to use the software. I mean, I think that's not that hard to do. I think that it's not tremendously hard to get consulting if you're good, but I think it's not that hard to make some software that'll make people pay attention to you so that they'll hire you to do work on it. But that's, I guess that's too modest a goal. I didn't think that was the goal here for what we're talking about. And the other one is much harder, and it's, to try and make something that'll change the world. The one thing that open source will do is it will get you the user base that makes people believe that your software is real. Because there's a lot of just, pieces of code out there, and if no one ever uses it, frankly, even if it was written by a good programmer, code that no one ever uses never gets the real refinement that turns it into a great project. So open source is a great solution to that, but just becoming a consultant or just getting a higher job as an Oracle DBA, I that doesn't sound like a great goal to me.
Yeah, good.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I guess firstly, the man on the end has the vote in terms of
my method. That's really what I tend to think about. Sometimes I think that's wrong, however. There's a lot of merit to actually just sitting down and bashing out a business plan and then just going to someone and saying, this is what I want to do. I need this much money to do it with. Will you help me? The trick is to find someone who is correctly aligned with your interests and that you know has a reasonable amount of money. People who have money are very partial to keeping it. They don't like to throw it away. So if you turn up at their door with a Porsche and then you want to check for $250,000 bootstrap money, they're just going to look at you and go, ha, this guy's going to waste my money. No chance. If you turn up in a used Toyota and you genuinely have a need for the money and you seem like an honest person, a lot of times if that person is an honest person, they're going to kind of take you under their wing and they're going to establish a relationship with you. There is a classic work on venture capital, I can't remember, but it identifies about 40 different kinds of money, and it has everything from sort of nasty money through really nice money through the money from your dentist through, you know, there's all sorts of different sources of money out there. Now, those are kind of dry right now. And I'm inclined to believe that a lot of that's artificially so, but then I'm paranoid, so that's not surprising. But there are other sources of funding, and the amount of money that you have is really the difference between what you're spending on just your everyday living expenses and on development and what you're getting in. So if you want to work less on doing some sort of DBA project or whatever, the best way to do that is to reduce the amount of money that you spend. You can do that in many ways. You can drive a crappy car. You can take public transport everywhere. You can grow vegetables. Growing vegetables is a very good thing to do if you write software. You go out there, you stick your hands in the ground. It's incredibly grounding.
You won't hear that at RSA.
You get to meet all sorts of nice creatures, and you can go to the garden center and buy plants and germinate things. It's just this marvelous activity. So I thoroughly...
And you get root easily.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Good one. Okay. That I'm going to conclude, so.
I'm sorry.
I guess it should be known that I'm not an Oracle DBA.
Okay.
But also that there are a lot of ways to raise money, and the point I guess I'm hoping that you'll get from what these guys have said so far is that you'll have to be somewhat opportunistic about it, you know, and maybe reducing costs and taking advantage of the income you already have. It may be taking advantage of your dentist who knows you and already thinks that, you know, you're a smart computer whiz. But in general, you know, even in my experience, I personally have pitched in front of probably a third or a half of the VCs in the Valley, and I'm still pretty young, I think. And the thing about that is, you know, most of those guys didn't know me and don't know me and didn't give me any money. But also, you know, a lot of the people who did give us money most of the time, and most of the time in my friends' experience that I've seen and the other folks I know who raised money, a lot of times it's old frat buddies. It's people who, you know your dad. It's somebody, you know, one way or another, if I'm going to give you money, I want to be comfortable knowing that I just want to be comfortable with the deal, you know. I'm separating with some of my money. I'm expecting to get more back. I just need to be comfortable. And there's any number of ways you could make somebody comfortable with giving you their money, but it's not just having a business plan and a suit and a Volvo, you know.
A Volvo? I sort of feel like, at least I'm being a disappointment on the panel, because we're not giving you maybe some of the answers you want to look for. And one of the sort of probably pariah statements I'm going to make, but I have seen it be the formula that's happened in the past, is that open source is in part philanthropy. There are business motives for it, but a lot of people do their open source work, and I certainly have, partly because I just want to give something out to the world. And it may mean that the right strategy to do open source is to go out there and do a business with your skills, and strictly as a business, you know, exchange of money for what you do, and make a lot of money that way, and use that to fund your philanthropy. That's, you know, that's what a lot of people do. There are some people who've made large money from open source, but a lot of other open source that we've seen has come from people who built some money in the old, in other businesses, hardware businesses, and traditional software or closed source businesses, and then they use that to produce either funding for a project, or they just became wealthy enough that they could take time off and spend a year coding a project that they just wanted to give to the world. And you know, that's not a great answer, because it's pretty obvious, but it may be the most productive answer.
What other different business models that you guys can think of for working on open source projects? I mean, one is, like you're saying, you know, start a business that can hopefully spend some of its revenue or dedicate some of its resources to coding open source project. But, you know, I can only think of a couple. Maybe another example is BerkeleyDB, I think, is a phenomenal example. Anybody interested in licensing open source software should consider what they've done, which is they develop open source software, provide it under open source license, but then they sell it to commercial groups who want to use it under a commercial license, so they couldn't go both ways.
I think that's a great system. I mean, it wouldn't meet Richard's tests for purity.
Yeah.
And
of course.
Or the open source definition.
Yeah. No.
It does. But I mean, they don't. What they give up, they still GPL their software.
Right.
But what they give up is the ability to take outside submissions because they don't own it. So that's just an example.
I never think that taking outside patches directly actually turns out to be too much of an advantage anyway, because you end up going through and verifying all the patches. So I think that having people submit patches and patching them in is not actually such a bad solution most of the time.
Well, on that Subversion project, we have 3 full-time developers, and we have basically the project has gone from, you know, 0, because it started from the, you know, with those guys starting it, to 11, 12, like, people who look like they're spending full time on it. Maybe it's, you know, 3/4 time or half time, but there's serious review of patches going on. These guys have commit privileges. I mean, it's high quality. It's really high quality work going on. And, I mean, that's the justification, ultimately, that I end up using with these guys, right? That what they're building is actually really complex, hard to get right, needs a very wide QA team and a really wide set of eyeballs looking at it, and really rigorous architectural thought put into it. And you can't get that by 3 guys just inside a company doing that themselves. Right. And then if we can make money building something like way on top, like in a GUI or something like that, great. You know, that's the where, you know, you can have the economics and the kind of model kind of works out better for that. But the point I was going to talk about, somebody mentioned Cygnus, right? And so Cygnus I mentioned a lot in this chapter I wrote in 1998, but what I've been troubled by is how generalizable is the Cygnus situation, right? How much can it really be extrapolated to all other parts of the software industry, right?
I mean, they really... Describe real quick about Cygnus for people who don't know.
Okay, so Cygnus, not Cygness, was a company that was bought by Red Hat last year, 2 years ago, something
2 years
like
ago,
that.
I think.
They basically were the company to go to when you wanted to have GCC, or the GNU compiler chain, compiled to, or ported to a different architecture, right? So all of these companies that built chips would go and get compilers built, or GCC ported to their platform. And this was, you know, all the big IT companies, even companies like Sony for the PlayStation and stuff like that. And the reason why they were able to build a profitable business out of that is, and this is Mike Thiemann's analysis at least, they hired all of the smartest people out there who had used the compiler tool suite, you know, at some point in their career, like where they were college students and that was the tools that they used, or just were otherwise smart compiler people, and built down and basically got the process of building, you know, doing that kind of development on spec down to a science, so that when they said this is going to take 5,000 hours to do or 100,000 hours, they could be, you know, 50-90% sure that that was actually how long it was going to take, right? And so it was a particular type of software that was very complex. The skill set out there was very rare, right? They were able to just develop into such a science because they actually had been going at it since 1989, I think it was. I think they were founded in 89 or 90. It was early. Yeah. So the question is, why don't we see companies like that around Apache? And there is one. They're Covalent. Covalent have been doing pretty well. But expertise in Apache and how to optimize it, how to configure it, is much more commonplace than it is in compiler technology, because you know people are a lot more interested in how web servers run, and it's easier to learn that kind of technology. So they're plugging away at it, but they've also got a significant part of what they sell that is a proprietary thing. I don't know. I mean, it's Cygnus is a great example, right? It's hard to come up with too many more examples of that, though. I wouldn't call Red Hat as a whole as an example of that kind of success yet.
Red Hat's total revenues, I think Cygnus is still a big part of their total revenues.
Yeah, they were the one that got Red Hat profitable.
That's right. And Cygnus is an absolutely great company, and they've got great services, and I think everyone here probably uses their software. And they were the model that I suppose when people like Richard Stallman started preaching how free software would work, they said, you know, you won't make money from trying to charge people for copies of software. You'll make money by selling expertise about the software, and that's one of the things that Cygnus did. But I have to echo Brian's question. How many, all the Cygnuses in the world still wouldn't amount to what Microsoft is financially. Probably all the Cygnuses there could ever be would not amount to financially what Microsoft is. So that's a hard question. I don't know if you want to get to the audience on this, because we're blabbering up here.
I can't remember exactly what time this is supposed to end. So you guys interrupt whenever you're... do you know when I'm supposed to end, Bryce? 4:45? 15 minutes? Okay, I guess we're ready for questions. Yeah. Let's get one of these mics out in the audience. I'll pull some Sally Jesse action here.
So, Dave Del Toro, Crypto Rights. I kind of have a model for how to fund this sort of stuff, but I'm encountering some difficulties because of the psychological makeup of the open source community. And I'm very purist in terms of wanting things to be open source and be widely available, and I found this business model, if you want to call it that, where you take, human rights and you take cryptography and you try and mush them together and figure out how they need each other, and there are lots of ways that they need each other. But one of the things that occurs to me while I'm listening to the presentations and listening to you guys, and no disrespect intended to anybody in the room, but one, I rarely hear a seriously real-world, realistic approach to how to make money. And two, all of the smart people in this room are coming up with all these great ways to do network protocols. And they fail, it seems to me, to see that human beings are also nodes in a network. And the closest thing I heard said to this is what you said, which is, your friends or people you've known for a really long time are the ones who are going to give you money because they feel comfortable about it. So if you're considering this ad hoc network of possible funders, and you can build, this brilliant ad hoc networking and all these wonderful distributed file sharing systems with all this authentication built into them, like, how long is it going to take before this community starts to realize they actually already have the solution? If they could just map the two worlds together and start thinking of how to get funding in a distributed way for things that everybody needs, that are where the expertise is rare, and they're the only ones who can deliver it. Like, how long is it going to take? I hope that by CodeCon, whenever the next one is, people have begun to figure out, you've actually been solving this problem. You just haven't put the right network units in place, The protocols exist. So, by the way, and I could turn this into a 10-minute question because I really wanted to be on this panel, but I will say this. We're going to have this Cypherpunks dinner meeting tomorrow, and I would just like to see a show of hands, knowing at least that I'm going to say something about this funding model that I'm developing. How many people here, so I can tell the restaurant how many people will be ready, are thinking of going to that tomorrow after CodeCon? Well, that looks like at least 25, 30 people, maybe more. Wow, great. Okay, we'll say roughly 40 to, somewhere. Great.
So the first thing I want you to know is that my girlfriend actually thinks that she's going to be coming to the Cypherpunks meeting as well, so that's pretty positive.
41.
If someone generally has a really good way of making money, they don't necessarily make it really obvious that they're making money. Because if they make it obvious that they're making money, then people try and take the money away from them. And so they tend to be closet about it. People who design machines that make money take revenue streams out of the machine in places you wouldn't possibly imagine. So I'll give you an example of a prominent video game company. They sell the video game box at a profit. Then they sell that to a distributor. The distributor then installs the phone line that runs the updates for the video game box out of their own pocket. So they basically make the box, and the box is made, and they make a small profit when it actually leaves the factory. Then they charge for tournaments which are played on the box. They don't charge for the regular games. The operator takes the revenue from that. And they will actually give the operator a loan, very nicely, to purchase the box, and the revenue can be applied against that. So they make money off the loan, and they make money off selling the box. Then they charge a percentage of the tournament games that are played on the box, so the distributors send them a check every week. And that company has money coming in through the door. It's profitable. Some of their software is based on open source technology. They actually made a physical object which sits there and charges people money for a service, and it is an at-will service. The person walks up to the box, they do something to the box, and something happens. It's a real, actual, physical exchange of money. So it is possible to make things that that actually will take people's money, and I don't think there's anything wrong in that. You know, we do have a basic lack of honesty at the moment in terms of sort of what people get for their money. And I think a lot of people kind of feel that that's devalued the currency quite a lot. And there are a lot of people who are hanging on to large globs of money which aren't circulating. Those people, if they don't reinvest them, they're going to go stale. Eventually, it has to unfreeze itself, one way or another. Either that or we end up in a big jam.
You guys have any other comments from the panel on ad hoc community fundraising?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I was trying to do with Source Exchange was, a failure existence proof does not make a failure for the model, certainly. I'll admit to that. But
although it does more often than people are willing to admit.
Yeah, I think... I won't go into the details of why or what we could have done better next time or something like that, but I think there's a tendency amongst people who think like us that building a successful business is just a matter of getting exactly the right algorithm, and then everything falls into place, or just the right model, just the right kind of offering, just the right whatever. And it's much more chaotic than that. It's much more dependent upon, you know, I mean, raising money is can you put on a good show for the investors, right? Can you get them excited about something? Selling a product is often a lot about that too. And it's so non-deterministic that to even try to apply, you know, programming principles to it starts to break down.
Every company is totally fucked up. The ones that win are the ones that are slightly less fucked up, basically.
Okay, kind of different what I was saying, but yeah, it's close.
Next question. Okay, but just to finish up, because I haven't actually heard my question answered, okay? Haven't. I will say that in the process of doing this thing, and I'm not going to name any names, because I think everybody has great intentions. In the process of doing this thing, one of the flaws that I've found is that when you rely upon people to collaborate on a large project and you ask them for a very simple piece of documentation, you very rarely get it. It's very hard.
That's true of the programmers I pay.
Exactly. So this is something that I'm exhorting everybody in the room to get better at, which is describe your work. Right? Because somebody like me who wants to go and aggregate those and bring it out and get people to pay so the money can funnel back to all the people who want to do the work, I can't do it unless people describe the work. I could do it for them, but then they would complain, you know, like, oh yeah, later on, you know, well, that's what we wanted to build.
So I was looking at the program and using my insider knowledge of the starving hacker industry, and I know something about half of the projects that are presenting here. I know something about how they're being developed. Of the ones that I know about, a little less than half are people who have day jobs and are working on this in their spare time, and a little more than half are people that are working on this full-time and spending their own personal capital to do so. There's no other, among the ones that I'm familiar with, there's no other funding represented here.
If someone has others...
I'm going to ask a question about the subject of this, which is money, do we need it? And there's a lot of talk, a lot of people talking about profiles and reputation. It doesn't really exist well distributed right now, but people like Amazon has profiles about you, and there's closed reputation systems that exist. But if they became open, to the extent that people could actually transfer reputation capital from one place to another and take their profiles, which are hugely valuable. There's a $1 trillion business in direct marketing of profiles.
There is not a trillion dollars.
Direct Marketing Association says $1.7 trillion in 2000. That's what they say.
It's a lot of money.
A lot of money. A lot of money in any case. The question is in a do you think, given that what doesn't exist now, which is an open distributed profile and reputation system, that there might actually become a way of using reputation capital exchange and profile exchange that actually might become at some point as valuable or perhaps more valuable than money?
I don't think so. I mean, I know when I've been in transactions where I've given money to people or people have said they would invest in me, there's always been something personal at the end. You may not know them when you first get together. You get introduced perhaps as strangers, but you're never going to do it because, oh, look, he's got this really great value in some reputation database because of a variety of anonymous comments. I mean, in the end, it's really going to come down to gut feelings whenever the amount of money gets over a certain amount. Yeah, if you want to invest $50 in someone because they have a great reputation, sure, you'll do that. I mean, the reason I wanted to contradict this trillion-dollar industry thing is because I was so sick of seeing websites and web companies being built on the idea that the information they would collect about their users was somehow more important or more valuable than the real fundamental service that they were supposed to provide. And that was clearly upside down. Right? So it's not a $1.7 trillion business to collect information on people, I don't think. If it is, it shouldn't be. So yes.
I had a question trying to maybe change the topic of this source of money from being strictly finding ways to get paid in terms of having a profitable product, for example, adding on top of public domain software to make a useful business, because I think some of the kind of changes that these products are looking at are broad enough, for example, having no ISP between me and my neighbor and free networking, that there may or may not be a viable business model, much in the same way that feeding poor people is not really a very good business model. Money goes out, it doesn't come back in. If we're trying to do good with our software, it really is calling in things like nonprofit organizations or getting money from the outside to help fund those activities. So I wanted to see the panel's comments on nonprofits or other philanthropic means of getting money for these kind of activities. First, perhaps Brad.
Well, I mean, that's what we do, and it's a hard struggle. The EFF is actually a little bit different from, for example, the ACLU. Now, we have a really good member base, and those members give us, some of them are loyal, and some of them we have to remind. But most of our money is still coming from larger donations from, not from corporations, but from individuals who agree with our causes. And we encourage, you know, any of you who want to do that to come. And we also encourage people just to become a regular $65 member, because that does make a difference. The members mean more than just money. They also mean a group of people who believe in the things that we believe in and who we can point to and say, look, there are these people that care about these issues when we try and make our point. There's no question, though, as a high-tech charity, that we're suffering from the fact that high-tech people are a lot poorer this year than they were before. And we're working to find ways around that. We don't do software development as a rule, although I'm trying to see if I can organize a project to get some software development done, but my general goal is to find open source programmers who want to do it as a philanthropic mission in order to bring encryption to be widely deployed in the world, which I think is an important thing, and the EFF thinks is an important thing.
Brian. Other way.
May not be quite on the topic, but we still lack a way of charging someone 65 cents for something. Be it software, be it anything. And the place where I live in Southern California is really a music industry place. It's where a lot of people go after they've been well masticated by the LA media machine. And there's a lot of musicians there who would love to be able to sell their work. And they'd love to be able to sell it for 65 cents a song or whatever. They would love to be able to do that. And there's no way that they're going to get exposure, and they don't have a chance in hell. And when they look at us, you know, saying that we're upholding freedom and we're giving all of these things away, and we don't give anyone a way to actually sell their work for a reasonable amount of money, they're just like, what are you doing?
I made a comment that that's not an accident. I think micropayments fail because human beings don't like making lots of tiny money decisions. Computers can easily account for tenths of a penny. The problem is human beings don't want to account for dimes. And micropayment systems often lead people into that track, and I think that's one of the reasons they failed.
Well, the biggest industry in this country is the telecom, right? And they're what are nothing else but a big billing system that can handle tiny transactions.
Yeah, they do.
They aggregate them for you and me, but they can do it.
But even though in local telephony, for example, where you have the choice of flat rate versus bill per minute, even though by far most of the users would pay less if they pick bill per minute, they all pick flat rate. And that's
right.
90% of them pick flat rate, and that's because they don't wish to worry about a meter running when they're on the local phone call. And frankly, if they could get it in long distance and they're starting to be able to, they would move towards that as well.
And I'm the same way buying music.
Yeah. Oh, well, no. I mean, I tried to push a movement in the free software movement 9 years ago, and I was unsuccessful. I said, instead of going around saying information wants to be free, how about information wants to be $10?
Yeah.
And you know, and I wanted to charge people $10 a month, and they could use all the free software they wanted, all the software that, well, it's free, but it's in that pool, and then we'd see what you were using, and we'd distribute the money out to the people whose software got used the most in some fashion. It's hard to come up with actual metrics, and I think it would have been a great model, and it would have possibly allowed people to write shareable software, obviously not free in the sense that people have to pay the $10.
Brian.
Anyway, what do we have time to go into all that right now?
I wanted to comment on the idea of having nonprofits potentially fund open source development. I'm president of the Apache Software Foundation, and you know we have a healthy kitty. We have about $100,000 in there. But we've always said we would not fund development of you know a particular developer to build things because actually we're most worried about legal liability, right? Not of that developer, but of part of the charge of the ASF is to protect the stuff that everyone else writes, right? Like we have 400 committers to the CVS tree and all their code, and they've all signed agreements assigning it to us, et cetera. And eventually, someday, someone's going to go, "That's my patented algorithm in there, right?" Or "That's my copyrighted code from the company that that developer wasn't supposed to give you, and I'm going to seek damages against you," and all that kind of crazy stuff. That just to answer that takes $50,000. So there's that. There's also the sense of unfairness, right? You know, it might. To pay a developer, even if they, you know, got down to the bare minimum, they didn't have to like charge as much, it would still probably be $30,000 a year, $40,000 a year, right? It takes a lot of time to raise that amount of money, you know, even though we've got more than that, it's been building up a while. And, you know, what's the amount of effort to do that and raise that amount of money versus going out and getting one more open source developer properly motivated to help solve whatever problem we'd be paying somebody for? Maybe we'd pay for better documentation or something, but, you know, it's this balance thing, right? So I'm not sure I'm a big fan of the idea of nonprofits funding a lot of open source work, maybe as grants or something for a specific project, but I think it might be hard.
We have time just to close up, and I wanted to make sure you guys got a chance, Ted, anything you wanted, but going with what Brian just said, what about, for the last thing I think we should cover for folks here is what about raising money, either because you're a nonprofit or from DARPA or any of the other folks who fund software development efforts? Then you guys want to mention something about your experience with that, that would be great. And wrap up at the same time.
I'm not sure you can raise money just with software. I mean, there's got to be return in the investor's mind behind it. And that means a business. It means a business they believe in and a business they don't believe the competition will do better at. And frankly, open source is a barrier to that in many investors' minds. I mean, there was a while when they felt it was not during 2 or 3 years ago. But obviously they ask the question, if this becomes successful, if this becomes as big as Windows, how can I get the 100 times return that I need on this investment or that I believe I deserve on this investment? And you know, it's not something you can answer easily. So you can't just come and say, I have cool software. I mean, that's never going to work.
I have nothing else to add. I mean, raising money, you know, you have to... To say it's open source software, it has to be like accidental, or you know, it's bigger, you know, it integral to some bigger strategy of world domination or something like that. You know, at least to try to get it from VCs who are in many cases playing with other people's money. So of course they're going to be pretty conservative.
My advice is like John Gilmore did: become employee number four at Sun. use that money to start another company, and then you can build Free Swan and give it out to people. So that's a very successful open source strategy. And John needs to be thanked for all the stuff he does in that area.
So if you're obtaining philanthropic money, then you have to find someone that is closely identified with your goals and aims in life. And if you are trying to make money, you have to make a machine that extracts money in all sorts of different places, not just one place. It has to have a robust revenue model with money flowing around, preferably involving all sorts of other people in the loop so that they're invested in your investment and are actively enfranchised in helping you make money. If you decide you're going to work for social change and you can't find anyone with money that believes in what you want to work in, then you have to grow vegetables.
Thanks. That's it for today. I appreciate it. See you guys tomorrow. Do we have some closing comments from Bram here?
All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is continuing, of course, tomorrow. I am so happy with how all the presentations have been going and how great you all are as an audience. And I just wanted to say thank you for that. And I'm really happy with this space. This is quite unusual having a conference in a concert hall, but this seems to be working really well. And in fact, you can come here later tonight and dance because there's a club happening here. And yes, and thank you all. And if your badge thing is not red, please go now because we have to clean up because the club that's opening here later tonight.